This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And today on the show, as we are in harvest season for many a great garden, Sue Balcom joins us with tips on preserving our garden bounty. And we'll have our What's Happening calendar of events. But first, from foster care to opioids and parenting to trauma survivors and endemic violence, there is an upcoming conference that tackles child welfare problems. Charlie Joyce is a licensed independent clinical social worker and a presenter at the Lutheran Social Services Therapeutic Partners in Child Welfare Conference, which is coming up on the campus of Minnesota State University Moorhead on October 8th and 9th. Charlie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Who should attend this conference?
We're targeting our audience as foster parents, adoptive parents, kinship parents, clinical social workers, clinical psychologists, anybody involved in mental health that serve children in child welfare, and also child welfare workers that usually are employed by county social services or private organizations that provide foster care.
Why specifically foster, kinship, and adoptive parents?
Well, they are the major servers of children that are not able to be with their own families. And we feel it's imperative that they receive good training and being able to respond to the challenges that the children that they have in foster, adopt, or kinship care may present in their home.
How many children in North Dakota are in foster care or in the adoptive process or might end up in a kinship care situation?
In the year 2017 in North Dakota, 1,359 children lived apart from their families in some type of out-of-home care. And that data is from the Child Welfare League of America.
And how does that compare with recent years? Do you know?
I believe that it is up recently. There was several years when the actual number of youth in out-of-home care had decreased, but unfortunately recently it has increased.
Do you know what some of the major factors are that might be contributing to the increase? Is it about refugee status? What's behind this?
It's generally thought that one of the major reasons that the number of youth in out-of-home care has increased is because of addiction, specifically the opioid epidemic. The other reasons that youth are in foster care is that they possibly have a parent that unfortunately has not been able to parent them in a way that's non-abusive or non-negligent. And as a result of those circumstances, they are removed from the home and placed in some form of out-of-home care. Generally, addiction or chemical abuse and physical and or other forms of abuse or child neglect go hand in hand.
Why might specifically the opioid crisis be contributing more than certain other addictions?
I think and this is really from a clinical perspective, what I see is that how opioids has affected the increase in number of children in care is, first of all, the accessibility. Secondly, is the rapid onset of addiction, where some substances, although not healthy for a family, can be used in a non-abusive capacity and an incapacitating capacity. And unfortunately, what we see with opioid abuse is often that the addictive qualities come fast and that the incapacitating qualities of the addiction move quickly also.
Mm. So you can have a beer and maybe it's not a problem, or maybe one time you have too many beers, but still it's one time. But opioids, much more likely to become a problem.
That's what we're observing, yes.
Okay. What are some of the other topics that you will be addressing at the Child Welfare Conference? And again, it's coming up October 8th and 9th at MSUM.
We're really proud of our agenda, if I may say that. And I also wanted to state that our efforts in providing this conference is collaborative with the Social Work Department at MSUM, okay, who have been wonderful partners. We have a speaker, Karina Berry, who will be our morning opening speaker on October 8th, and she is speaking on missing and murdered Indigenous women, which unfortunately, as you know, has been an issue that our own community has tragically had to deal with in the last year. Mm-hmm. And Ms. Berry comes to us from the University of Minnesota. She works as a researcher in child welfare, and she is an enrolled member of the Leechland Band of Ojibways. And she comes at this issue from a professional perspective, but also from a personal perspective, as her own family has had the tragedy of having a sibling that lost her life to murder, and that has not been solved. That is my understanding. So we're excited about Karina coming and being our opening presenter. We have Allison Blake coming, who comes to us from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, and she's coming to us from Baltimore. And previously, she was the director of child welfare services for the state of New Jersey. And Dr. Blake has been able to provide us with information as far as how in New Jersey they were able to decrease the number of children entering care. And I believe down through her tenure, it decreased approximately by 44%. So we're excited to hear from Dr. Blake and how she and her team of professionals in New Jersey were able to accomplish that decrease in number of children
and,
in care.
And does it seem like it's something that can be applicable to North Dakota?
We hope so. Okay. And also Minnesota. The audience we hope to draw from is North Dakota and Minnesota.
Okay.
Other people are certainly welcome if they're not from those two states, but that is our target. So we're certainly hoping that that Dr. Blake will provide us information that can be replicated.
And you are one of the speakers. You will be talking about youth transitioning to and from home visitations. We also have a session title on childhood and adolescent anxiety and treating that clinically. Again, the opioid crisis, like you mentioned, trauma-informed parenting, and transgender and gender nonconforming youth, and you'll be talking about incarcerated parents and the needs of those children, and then an ethical leadership overview. Are you only as good as the agency that you are working for? Where people from LSSND will be speaking about this. A couple of those, and they're all extremely important topics, but a couple stand out to me. We've talked about sort of the newness of the opioid crisis, and I'm wondering about when it comes to issues of transgender and gender nonconforming youth, there's a lot more understanding and awareness of this than there was even a decade ago.
Correct.
I just want to learn more about this specific panel. Why did you want to include this one?
Actually, it's not a panel. It's an individual speaker.
Oh, sorry.
That's fine. And Alex is well-received as a speaker. He just got rave reviews from people that helped us plan the conference. And his approach to this is that in order to serve youth that are in out-of-home placements, that may be struggling with the issue of gender identity, that it's very important that professionals involved with them, but also the parents, either again through kinship, foster, or adoptive care, have a basic understanding of what those struggles look like, how to support a child that's trying to work on or has already identified their gender, and how to support them in an out-of-home placement so that they can make as healthy of an adjustment as possible.
Are there other issues that non-binary or non-cisgender youth are more at risk for than even other people who are in foster care?
Unfortunately, what we found is that with youth that are identifying gender issues, that the suicide rate as they process that on an emotional and intellectual level can be very high. And so, yes, indeed, there is. And then, of course, there's the social stigma that's attached. So you couple that with the normal development of adolescence.
Which is miserable.
Unfortunately, can be. It presents many challenges for the youth. I have a high regard for the youth that are are really working on that and the people that serve them, because it's, once again, a very, very difficult issue for them to really try and figure out for themselves and to find acceptance.
There is going to be a panel discussion on the needs of unaccompanied refugee minors. How big of an issue is this in North Dakota?
Well,
and Minnesota.
Yeah, as you're aware, that in North Dakota, Lutheran Social Services does a degree of resettlement for youth that are refugee minors and are unaccompanied minors, meaning they're under the age of 18. They are here legally. And they come to our community and our region, generally from war-torn countries. And they come here often without mastery over language, unfamiliarity with our culture, unfamiliarity with our school system, and also unfamiliarity at times with our legal system.
Yeah.
And so the panel is a wonderful opportunity for one for youth that have come here as unaccompanied minor youth to have a voice, to talk about the adjustments they experienced. And we also have a staff member from the from Lutheran Social Services that will lead the panel that serves as a caseworker for the youth involved in that program. And we also have an educator, and we also have somebody from law enforcement. So we're able to respond to that issue from the perspective of multi-perspectives, but also the focus of the panel is really for the youth to be able to talk to the audience about what their adjustment was like.
One of the things that you talk about is hoarding food and behavioral wedding. What are some of the reasons that children hoard food?
Well, this is an interest of mine that I've had throughout my clinical practice because I've been involved with a lot of youth that have come out of deprivation and abusive situations. We find a number of the youth that come to us have not been properly nourished and actually come to out-of-home care malnourished. But they're brilliant youth in the way that they've developed ways to survive. And one of the ways that they've learned to survive is to hoard food when it's available so that they're able to have food when there's no food available, that they have their stash. And again, to me, it's a brilliant adaptations that they've been able to make as far as to deprivation regarding food. Unfortunately, what happens is that can lead then to them coming into a foster home, adoptive home, or a kinship home, and with professionals that don't understand the dynamics of why kids have had to hoard food for the reasons of survival. So that particular training that I will be doing in that area really focuses on how we can supportively respond to children that hoard food and help them really make a pro-social and healthy adjustment to now having food available so that they no longer need to hoard.
Yeah.
Similar to with behavioral wedding. And behavioral wedding, that term we use when there really isn't a medical reason for the wedding behavior, that it's behavioral in nature. And there's identified myself and a Dr. Rick Delaney, who I've worked with quite a bit, we've identified some reasons that children will do behavioral wedding. One is for protection and anxiety, that they might wet as a way that if they've been abused to really repel an offender. And if you think about that, it is, again, a brilliant behavior that's adaptive to an abusive situation. We also have youth that come to us that really have been neglected to the point where they've never been properly toilet trained. And so as a result, what I've discovered through my own clinical practice is many times that their wedding behavior is not offensive to them at all. It's normal. And then we hypothesize that there are some children that actually have wet as a reason to almost create a familiar environment in times of fear. Unfortunately, one thing we have to remember, with a lot of kids that go into foster care, they're going into homes that they don't know the family. And so that is, in many cases, extremely stressful for them because they don't know what's going to happen to them in that setting. So they'll use behaviors that in the past have been comforting to them. So that particular training that I'm doing, again, is of extreme interest to me and is, after many years of practice and consultation with Dr. Delaney, reviewing the strategies that we've come up with on how to supportively influence those two areas of behavioral wedding and also hoarding food.
We're visiting with Charlie Joyce, a licensed independent clinical social worker with Abound Counseling and a presenter at the Lutheran Social Services Therapeutic Partners in Child Welfare Conference. This conference is coming up October 8th and 9th at Minnesota State University, Moorhead. Charlie, we've mentioned that you've been doing this about 40 years now, and I'm wondering if there has been in 40 years something that used to be topical and in sort of a good news vibe you no longer feel like you have to be presenting about. Does that make sense?
That's a great question. I don't know if I can accurately answer that. I think actually the opposite is true, that many topics that previously throughout my 40-plus years didn't receive attention, such as the impact of trauma on youth, the impact of trauma on neurological development, things like we just discussed, hoarding food, that we've become much better at being able to identify some of the specific needs and specific challenges that youth that have experienced separation from their birth family because of possibly neglect or abuse, that some of the specific challenges that they have, I think we've got much better at identifying what they are and coming up with supportive ways to help them heal from those experiences.
The Therapeutic Partners in Child Welfare Conference, again, October 8th and 9th at MSUM. And there are some scholarship funds available for anyone who is not able to pay the $99 for both days. Where should people go if they want to attend?
That's a great question, and I appreciate you asking that, because we're very proud of that aspect of the conference. And that the scholarships that are available are a result of our very generous donors in LSS, specifically in North Dakota. We've targeted scholarships which pay for the registration for the whole conference or one day, whatever people select, for foster parents, adoptive parents, kinship parents, and also social work undergraduate and graduate students. In order to apply for one of those scholarships, the participant just needs to go to our webpage for the conference and start the registration process. There's a registration icon. They just have to click on that. That will take them to registration and the application for the scholarship. And the application is very easy. If you're, for instance, if you're a foster parent, it is click on foster parent and identify the agency you're licensed through. If you're an undergraduate or graduate social work student, same process, click on social work student and identify the institution.
And is this at lssnd.org/therapeuticpartners?
Or they can email me directly.
Okay.
And my email address is Charlie, CHARLEYJ, at lssnd.org.
All right, Charlie Joyce, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having us.
Charlie is a licensed independent clinical social worker. More Main Street in a moment.
The Bismarck Mandan Symphony Orchestra is for people who treasure music and the arts. Hi, I'm Maestro Beverly Everett. The 2018-2019 season, Time Travel, begins with American Pie, 7:30 p.m. September 15th at the Belle Mayhus Auditorium, featuring principal clarinetist Rhonda Gowan and the music of Aaron Copland and Leonard Bernstein. Tickets are available online at bismarckmandansymphony.org.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming, along with our members and other sources, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Historian Tom Ezern is an avid reader. And what a better way to while away one's time than by reading a good saga. Here's this week's Plains Folk essay.
Attending the Deuce of August celebration in Mountain, whereat Prime Minister Katrin Jakobsdottir charmed the North Dakota crowd, stirred my interest in our Icelandic immigrant heritage. I've written about Her Excellency's joyous appearance in Mountain and about the courageous service of the Icelandic midwife, Aldis Laxdal, whose monument stands in the Vikur Lutheran Cemetery. My go-to source as to matters Icelandic in northeastern North Dakota is Thorstina Walters, author of Modern Sagas, The Story of the Icelanders in North America, published by the Institute for Regional Studies in 1953. Rereading the Walters work after a gap of years, I'm deeply impressed. First, because the author was an impressive woman, born the daughter of Torleifr Jokomsen, Americanized to Jackson, and Gudrun Jonsdottir in Pembina County, North Dakota. They were of the Icelandic stock who had come first to Manitoba and thence to Dakota Territory. Manifesting the Icelandic penchants for educational attainments and literary pursuits, Thorstina Jackson taught school, became a social worker, and took graduate work at Columbia University. There and thereafter, she pursued studies in Icelandic history, culture, and emigration. King Christian X of Denmark and Iceland awarded her the Knight's Cross and the Order of the Falcon. She was an active organizer of the Icelandic Millennial Celebration in 1930. Meantime, she had married another child of Icelandic immigrants, Emil Walters, a landscape artist who, on returning to his North Atlantic homeland, reinvented his style to depict its stunning landscape. Later, he would bring his style to bear in paintings of the Badlands of North Dakota. He, too, received the Knight's Cross and Order of the Falcon. Thorstina Walters continued her career in social work during the 1930s, then worked in the Censorship and War Information Department during the Second World War, while Emil undertook government missions in Iceland. In 1944, Thorstina was stricken with multiple sclerosis, one consequence of which was the revival of her historical interests. With a fellowship from the University of Minnesota and drawing on her father's research as well as her own, she wrote Modern Sagas, a work that presents and interprets the Icelandic immigrant experience for the rest of us. The first thing I noticed on rereading the book is that the introduction was penned by none other than Alan Nevins, the acclaimed biographer and historian, author of the 8-volume History of the Civil War, The Ordeal of the Union. This contribution no doubt derived from Thorstina's years at Columbia University. The second thing I noticed is that Thorstina Walters presents her people compellingly as the salt of the earth, as people who cherish all that is good about their ethnic heritage, but also exemplify the best of American values. I think about the time of publication, when the public ideal was the melting pot, and when English-speaking Americans expected immigrants to abandon all that was dear to their heritage, and I am moved by Thorstina's gallant portrayals. Third, several times, while reading of Thorstina's parents and home life, I was so deeply moved that I had to lay the book aside and collect myself for a few minutes. Now I return to her description of the winter ritual of the Rookersfitten, the twilight nap that took place in the interval between an early supper and the later evening when the family assembled for readings and recreation. This will be my model for our upcoming northern winter.
Tom Easern is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University. Still to come on Main Street, it's harvest season. Sue Balcom joins us with tips on preserving the bounty, and NPR's Jim Zaroli covers how North Dakota farmers are faring in the age of trade wars. But now it's time for the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration has announced plans officials say will help crack down on teenage use of e-cigarettes. Officials say the actions are needed as we see the rate of teens becoming addicted to nicotine reaching epidemic proportions. Neil Shervat is Tobacco Prevention and Control Program Director with the North Dakota Department of Health. He says there are many challenges in preventing teen access to e-cigarettes, and there is a lot of misinformation about the hazards. Shervat says it took 40 years to drive home the point of the dangers of tobacco products. He says there is a new obstacle to overcome when it comes to e-cigarettes.
This current generation of youth is kind of the guinea pig generation. I guess we'll find out down the road how this affects people in the long term. This is going to be the generation that gets studied for that. But until we know it's safe, I think we can't say, yeah, they're safe to use. And that's the big issue we're facing right now.
Shravat says while the use of tobacco is down among teens, there have been dramatic increases in teens using e-cigarettes.
The high school smoking rate, excuse me, was at about 22% in 2009 and is at about 12% right now as of 2017. So that's a great reduction, reduced that by 10%. But the electronic products, which didn't even exist, for example, high school rate in 2011 showed 1.6% of high schoolers using. Now that rate's at 19.1%.
Shravat says as part of the effort to reduce teen usage, the health department will be going to lawmakers next session to get e-cigarettes categorized as a tobacco product. And the candidates for North Dakota's Secretary of State held their first debate in Fargo on Wednesday. Issues ranged from the voter ID laws to technology needs in the office. Democratic candidate Josh Boucher says incumbent Al Jaeger has been slow to implement new technology, and he said people who need to register their businesses with the office have been frustrated.
And that's why I've proposed, along with my colleague Kylie Overson, who's running for tax commissioner, the North Dakota Hub, which is essentially a one-stop shop for businesses, nonprofits, and again, family farmers to access what they need for government. To comply with government regulation shouldn't be burdensome. Our job should be to make it easy and get out of the way.
But Jaeger says his office has been modernizing and will soon unveil new technology.
We're just a matter of weeks away to having one of the finest systems in the entire country. It is a done deal, people, and it's going to be absolutely great.
Boucher responded that Jaeger missed the target date he outlined for legislative committees on when that new system would be up and running. Jaeger countered that he would rather have it done right than make what he called a political deadline. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Harvest is underway, and with it comes new concerns for farmers. The administration's trade policies have helped drive down the prices for crops as foreign markets, such as China, pull back on their purchases. NPR business reporter Jim Zaroli traveled from New York to North Dakota this week to cover how farmers are reacting. And he stopped by our studio. Jim, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
What are you doing in North Dakota?
Well, I got interested in doing a story on the soybean farming. It's a crop that has become one of the most important in the United States, and that's largely because of China, because of the Asian market, because soybeans are used as Chinese and other Asian countries too, but especially the Chinese have developed a taste for pork as they've, you know, as the middle class has grown. Mm-hmm. And that means there's a hunger for soybeans. And a lot of farmers now grow soybeans who didn't used to, and that's especially true in North Dakota. Farmers who used to grow wheat or barley have found that soybeans are a really profitable crop. They've developed really good, strong economic relationships with China. And now that's all been thrown into question because of the tariffs, because when the United States put tariffs on Chinese imports, China retaliated. And one of the things that they retaliated against was imports of soybeans. So I wanted to do something on how the soybean industry has developed, how it grew, and where it stands today.
Right, because North Dakota is the fourth overall in the United States for soybean acres. Do you know when that moved up? Like you mentioned, there are a lot of farmers who didn't used to farm soybeans, and now they are doing that.
It seems like it was around the mid-90s it really took off, and there were different reasons for that, technological reasons. But one of the big things was the opening of the Chinese market. China joined the WTO in the early 2000s, and there's just been this steady growth in soybean planting.
And now it's 70%, more than 70% of North Dakota soybeans are exported, primarily to, I've read on the Soybean Council page, China, Indonesia, Taiwan, and Thailand.
Yeah. So it's a big deal for North Dakota. Yeah. I mean, it's a big deal for other states too. And North Dakota also has manufacturing. You know, I spent some time at a factory in Wahpeton. It's one more manufacturer that's been affected by the tariffs. And there are other manufacturing plants too that are being hit by it. So, you know, this is a state that exports a lot. Mm-hmm. People don't know that. People don't think about that, but it is. And so it has there's a lot at stake in terms of what's going on with our trade policy.
So what did you learn in the course of your reporting, the farmers and the manufacturers that you did talk to? Are they very open about how the tariffs are impacting their work?
You know, I know that this is a state that voted for Donald Trump, and I think a lot of people have that question. You know, well, you're being hurt by it, these tariffs. How can you still support Donald Trump? What I found talking to people was that a lot of farmers in particular think that they generally approve of what Trump is doing. They think the United States has been taken advantage of by trading partners, especially China. And there are a lot of people who would agree with that. China has done a lot of things over the years in terms of closing off its markets, in terms of subsidizing industries. China has some things to answer for. So I think a lot of people think – a lot of the farmers that I talk to think, well, yeah, it's about time that this got taken care of. At the same time, they're very concerned about what's coming, and they're very hopeful that Trump can sort of pull a rabbit out of the hat at this point and come up with some kind of trade deal that brings prices back up, because soybean prices have fallen a lot, and so have other crops. They all tend to fall together, mm-hmm. fall at the same time.
Well, and I think a lot of people don't really realize that farmers decide what they are going to grow based on contracts that are sometimes established a year, sometimes even more in advance. Did you hear from any farmers who are soybean farmers in North Dakota who are looking to bail out on soybeans and move to whatever might be next?
I think they're thinking about it. I think they don't know what to do. You know, this could all turn around in a couple months. It doesn't seem like it's going to, but it could. Mm-hmm. And then it won't have made sense to quit planting soybeans.
Sure.
They certainly are thinking about it. You know, I visited a farm family. That was one of the questions I asked. Are you going to plant – you know, they plant wheat, they plant corn, but most of what they plant are soybeans. Mm-hmm. And I asked them that. I said, are you going to plant less next year? And they said, absolutely.
Really?
Yeah.
How did you find your farmers?
Actually asked the Soybean Growers Association, and Nancy Johnson, who's the executive director, mm-hmm. Hooked me up with them. And you know, they were very helpful and very open, and took me around their farm and took me to the grain terminal where they use. I mean, there's a huge infrastructure that's been built up in North Dakota and other states. But 20 years ago, you didn't have these, you know, you didn't have the same infrastructure to bring soybeans to market. And now you do. One of the problems for farmers in North Dakota is a lot of this infrastructure has been built to carry crops to the Pacific Northwest, because that's where crops get offloaded and sent to Asia. So it's not so easy for them to find new markets. Farmers in other parts of the country may have access to different ports. Here, it's really – a lot has been built up around the notion of opening up the Asian markets, and they have. And it's been great. People have made a lot of money, and now there's this big question mark.
It's – you know, you mentioned that a large percentage of North Dakota voters did go for Trump. And in terms of presidential politics, North Dakota has long been a red state with some sort of anomalies, if you will, in the congressional delegation going back, for decades mm-hmm. of service from Democrats like Conrad and Pomeroy. And mm-hmm. and then now in 2012, Heidkamp barely did eke out a win over Rick Berg, and now much focus on the Heidkamp and Kramer Senate race. Do you get into the politics of this in your piece, or does it stick primarily? Obviously, there's politics when you talk about the president's setting tariffs, but specific to the upcoming midterms.
You know, I was going to, but I think that we have people that cover politics, and I'm really in that. I cover trade and economics, and so I decided to stick to that. I did hear Senator Heitkamp speak yesterday at the Big Iron Farm Show. She talked at length to the farmers there about the tariffs, about what's going on. I also interviewed Senator Hoeven. He was there. Mm-hmm. I just was asking him about, you know, what farmers can expect, what he's hearing from farmers, and what, you know, what's on their minds. And he basically told me that the farmers in North Dakota understand what the president is doing, trying to crack down on abusive practices by China, but they're really hoping that something can be done. They're very worried, and they really hope that there can be some kind of deal worked out, you know, over the next few months.
What do you think of Big Iron?
It was very interesting. It's, you know, and the people were very nice. You know, in a lot of places, if you walk around with a microphone recording people, they are not very friendly about it. But nobody said
anything.
You're
from New York.
I know.
Very different population.
Yeah. Well, if you walked around in New York recording people, you know, just on the street, a lot of people would say, "What are you doing?" Mm-hmm. And I didn't get that there. So, but it was very interesting. There's a lot going on there. A lot of equipment makers, farm equipment makers. You know, a lot of farmers walking around, but a lot of companies go there to try to sell things. And of course, I was asking them two things. I was asking them, are they hurt by the steel tariffs? And they all said yes. But I also was asking them, has the market seemed to soften because of the concerns in farming? And the ones I talked to also seemed to think it was.
Do you think that you will do more reporting from North Dakota?
Yeah, I'd like to. I'd like to come back. It's always very valuable to get out of, you know, get away from your desk, as I'm sure you know.
Jim, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
That was NPR business reporter Jim Zaroli. His first piece from North Dakota aired during today's Morning Edition. Coming up next, Sue Balcom.
I've always felt like I have six characters inside me. I don't know what that says about me, but one of them was always to play a musician.
Bradley Cooper has had a story to tell for a long time.
I went to bed that night and I had a dream about the first 10 minutes of the movie.
Now he's unveiling it and singing it in his directorial debut, A Star Is Born, on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and in our Bismarck studio is Sue Balcom from the Root Cellars Farm outside of Mandan. Sue, thanks for joining us again.
My pleasure, Ashley. It's good to be here.
It's a wonderful time of year when the garden is overflowing. Sometimes people feel a little overwhelmed and wondering just how many tomatoes, how much corn, how many carrots you can eat. But then, of course, you got to remember you can those and have them all winter long. So, Sue, we need a lot of tips on canning, and you sent an email with a couple bullet points to talk about, and I'm just going to confess ignorance here because you say pressure canning, and I'm just wondering, is there a difference between canning and pressure canning?
Absolutely, and it's so funny because I do some pressure cooking and some pressure canning, and I remember making ribs and sauerkraut for my aunt and uncle and everybody at Easter time. And, you know, the first words out of someone's mouth when you tell them you have a pressure cooker or a pressure canner is, "You're going to blow yourself up." And I'm like, no. It's not that different from water bath canning, but you do need some special tools and a little bit more knowledge, I guess, about what you're doing.
Okay. So the special tools, just the pressure cooker?
Right. You need a really good pressure canner. Now, do not use your pressure cooker for canning and vice versa. You don't want to bits of food in your pressure canner because that gets on the outside of your jars and, yeah, it's just gunky. So I have two separate units that I use for pressure cooking and then pressure canning. And it's hilarious to me because my daughter-in-law wanted an Instant Pot. And so I have to laugh because an Instant Pot is basically an electric pressure cooker. And just because they call it an Instant Pot, now people can't say, you're going to blow yourself up.
There's marketing geniuses everywhere. So.
So the difference between the water bath canning and the pressure canning is that pressure canning is basically what they do to can food that you find in the grocery store. And you can actually buy cans and pressure can in cans. But I do it, of course, in my jars. And you have to pressure can low acid foods. You cannot water bath beans or corn or meat or any dairy products like that. You have to absolutely pressure can those. So if you're new to canning, you should stick with the water bath canning method. And for that, you can use tomatoes and fruits.
Oh, good. So I'm right just by just because those are the things I have.
Well, you know, and this is the time of year where when I come home from work, I'm like, let's see, what should we have for supper? And you can kind of like just walk around the garden, grab some tomatoes, grab a pepper, grab a zucchini, and you can cook right out of the garden. So this is my favorite time of year. But like you said, when you have excess that you just don't know what to do with, you really have to learn how to can. It's really, really, really the best way to preserve food because in the event that your electricity goes out, you know, your freezer will thaw. Well, unless it's December in North Dakota, then maybe it won't thaw. But, you know, it's the best way to preserve things and you don't have to worry about anything except your seals breaking.
Okay. What's your sterilization method for the jars?
The best thing that you can do is wash them in hot soapy water and then I use my water bath canner with the rack in and I turn the jars upside down and I kind of keep the water at a low simmer whilst I'm preparing my food. So you've got your jars upside down. They're in the hot water. They're getting steamed up really good. As far as equipment for water bath canning, there are special grabbers that you can get for grabbing lids out of hot water and also to grab your jars. I always wear one rubber glove on my left hand because things get hot and you have to be very careful that you don't burn yourself. It's kind of like having a baby, you know, like, oh, it's time to can. Let's get the towels and the hot water boiling, you know. But it's so much fun and it's so gratifying too. You know, you've got your jars hot and you fill them with hot food and you put them back in there for the time, which I would totally suggest going to extension as far as finding recipes that are safe to water bath can and then procedures like time-wise. Some things you only need to water bath can for 10 minutes. Some you need to water bath can for 20 or 30. But it's not that difficult. And then you take them out of that hot water and you set them on your counter and you don't disturb them for 24 hours, but you're in front of the television and you're going, that's joy. Joy to a canner's ears is when their jars seal.
Does it make much of a difference if you put the food in while the jar is hot?
You absolutely should have hot, when you're water bath canning, your food, like if you're canning tomatoes, you know, everything that's warm is better. You know, like you put your hot food into hot jars and then they go into hot water because, as you know, glass expands and contracts. And if you take a cold jar and put it into hot boiling water, the bottom's going to fall out of it and you're going to lose everything that you worked so hard to get in there. Mm. And so that's something that you really, really have to be careful with, which is why I put them in simmering water. You also have to simmer the bands and the lids when you're doing water bath canning, because then that way everything is kind of like close to the temperature that it takes to be safe. So when you put your jars under, the water. They have to be completely covered with water in your canner. So some canners can hold 7 jars, some can hold only 5. I have a big, beautiful canner that I finally treated myself to.
Mm.
But I also have a glass top stove. And a lot of times people will say things to you that'll make you really terrified to can and eat any food. But it's really just common sense. But glass top stoves work perfectly fine for canning and pressure canning if you remember that you need a flat bottom canner. If you have a canner that has like the ridge underneath it, it traps hot air inside of there, which will cause that glass top stove to break. So get a stainless steel canner with the flat bottom and never, never, ever slide it across your glass top stove. If you just can something and leave that set there until you can empty it and lift it off of there, you should be fine. I've been canning on mine now for heavy-duty canning on mine now for about 7 years and have had no problems whatsoever.
So since you're hundreds of miles away and can't strangle me, I am going to admit that one of my earliest excursions in canning was a somewhat rare apricot harvest in my yard. I've been there 10 years, and I've only gotten 2 usable apricot harvests. And I picked up a French canning book because I like to pretend that my French is that good. And they don't do the putting the can in the hot water afterwards. They just turn the can upside down, or at least this book. And I did it, and I ate the jam, and I'm still alive.
Okay, so here's the deal. You're talking about a high sugar content preserve, correct?
Okay, yes.
Okay, so if anybody from Extension is listening to me right now, close your ears because I do that too.
Okay.
Like when I'm making jelly, you know, you've got boiling hot sugar syrup and you've got a hot jar and a hot lid, and we fill those up, leaving some headspace, and turn them upside down for, you know, 5 or 10 minutes or whatever. Turn them right side up again and they will seal.
Yeah.
They may not seal for 7 years like my grandmother's jars did, but they will seal long enough for you to get that eaten. And here's the secret to canning anything, whether it's water bath or pressure canning. If you take it from your root cellar, wipe the top of it off with a towel because it's probably dusty. Remove the ring, and if that seal is broken, don't eat it. You know, that means that it's been contaminated probably. And if you do have something that's sealed that does have mold around it by some small stroke, don't eat that either. And if it smells bad or if the food is soft, throw it away. It's better to be safe than sorry. I don't know of any incidences where anybody's gotten sick since about the 1930s when it comes to canning. But you will hear, perhaps, if you're interested in canning, that back in the 30s, somebody died, like they killed off their whole family with peas or something like that. Well, I did a little research into that myself, you know, when I did my cookbooks for the Germans from Russia, and they didn't use pressure canners back then. They had wood-burning stoves. So all they did was they boiled the life out of their vegetables like 6 or 7 hours.
Yeah.
To can them. I know, right? So why would you want to even eat that in the first place? And then secondly, of course, this woman had not practiced good, clean canning, and therefore they all died. And I'm sorry to hear that, but really it is not as dangerous as what some people would like to believe. If you have questions, find somebody who's been, you know, canning for years. Jackie Clay wrote a great book about canning and preserving. I think she's from Minnesota. I had the pleasure of meeting her at a conference I went to. So when in doubt, seek it out from somebody who knows.
All right. Thank you, Sue.
Thank you, Ashley.
Sue Balcom joins us once a week to talk about food. She is with the Root Cellars Farm outside of Mandan.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative of Bismarck, producing reliable electricity. Basin Electric operates generation stations in North Dakota, South Dakota, Montana, and Wyoming, including wind farms in North and South Dakota.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 13th. North Dakota remembers World War I. As more young men left for the battlefields of France, service flags were proudly displayed in homes, businesses, churches, and social organizations across North Dakota. In fact, service flags were such a popular display of patriotism that service flag stationery became available. Each page of writing paper or envelope contained a star for each member of the family serving in the military, along with the emblem of the branch of service to which they belonged. By mid-September, North Dakota had 25,000 men in military service, and the casualty lists continued to grow. As the blue stars on service flags turned to gold, the efforts to provide comfort and care to the battle-worn troops became even more important. Red Cross efforts increased across the state. This had become a routine for most homemakers. In Balfour, Mrs. J.J. Thomas had established a new record for the number of socks knitted in a day. Not to be outdone, Harry Weber, a pool room operator from Havana in Sargent County, knitted 68 pairs of socks for the Red Cross, making him the male champion knitter. While it was said that the Salvation Army met the battered soldier at the mouth of the trench with food and coffee, the Red Cross ambulances and hospitals were as close to the trenches as possible to administer to the wounded. Images of Red Cross nurses sent a powerful message to the people back home. Images of nurses in their angel-like white dresses adorned with the cross-shaped emblem of mercy, listening to those whispered last words of a dying soldier. But not all Red Cross nurses cared for the wounded. On this date in 1918, the American Expeditionary Forces captured the railroad town of Toole. Edith Van Veach, a Red Cross nurse from Gilby, North Dakota, said fate intervened, and instead of nursing, she helped set up a canteen at Toole. Over an 11-month period, she helped make the 461,114 donuts served at the canteen. She also stated that one-tenth of the 1,561,625 sandwiches made with thick white bread, sardines, cheese, and jam were made by that daughter of North Dakota. And when a son of North Dakota dropped by, an extra piece of cheese, an extra spoonful of jam, and the largest Hershey bar went into his package. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jim Davis. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
That's it for this Thursday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, author Rebecca Walker will be a featured speaker at the annual Faith, Reason, and World Affairs Symposium coming up next week at Concordia College in Moorhead. The symposium theme, Power Plays, Why Gender Matters. Walker joins us to discuss her writing and her activism and what she plans to say at the symposium. That's coming up tomorrow on the show. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.